Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me, as always, is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XLVIII, Trajan, Optimus Princeps. We've heard how Trajan came to become a great and respected military leader, and how he took on Dacia and finally brought them to heel. But Trajan was more than just a man of the sword. He was a man of the people and a man of the Senate. And now we look at how he cemented that reputation of being the greatest emperor since Augustus and the one that everybody has to live up to. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Trajan is widely regarded as an excellent emperor. He was sort of the polar opposite of all of those bad emperors we've listed. So didn't do the things like that Nero and Domitian did, like randomly apparently killing senators, being very suspicious and paranoid like Domitian, being unfair, not being worried about military or civil works. So he's the opposite of all of that. He does those things. He behaves in the way that at least the Roman elite seemed to expect an emperor to behave. Mm. So they, who provide our admittedly rather thin sources for this period, seem to be very happy with Trajan's behaviour.
So we know that Pliny, for example, was extremely happy with Trajan's behaviour, but what do we know about what other people thought specifically?
Well, of course, Pliny wrote the Panegyricus, yeah. And that's got to be all good news, hasn't it? It's got to be all praise of the emperor. Our other main source, Dio, really begins his description of Trajan's reign with a long passage that describes Trajan's character. That's not something he always does, but this is clearly important to him in setting out the field for what Trajan's reign is going to be like. So book 68 is the one that covers Trajan's reign of Dio Cassius. Dio Cassius says that, shall I read it here?
Yeah, read it here. Right, give the reference.
Dio Cassius in book 68, chapter 6, section 3 onwards, and it's quite a long section, but I think it's important. He says, Trajan was most conspicuous for his justice, his bravery, and for the simplicity of his habits. All of those are good, and simplicity is important because that contrasts with the extravagance that we've seen in other emperors. And it harks back to Augustus, who was known to have a very simple house, that he didn't spend a lot of money on luxury, personal luxury. And that's always a good thing to hark back to Augustus. So he goes on, he was strong in body, being in his 42nd year when he began to rule, so that in every enterprise he toiled almost as much as the others. So he's not a slacker. He works just as much as the workers. And, I like this bit, his mental powers were at their highest, so that he had neither the recklessness of youth nor the sluggishness of old age. And we could just write a list of emperors under each one there, I think.
Yeah, well, I guess at both sides you've got Domitian and Nerva as the most recent examples in this mind. So Dio's essentially going, you know, we've lucked out because he's not like them.
Exactly. Okay, he carries on. There's just nothing wrong with this man. He did not envy nor slay anyone, but honoured and exalted all good men without exception, and hence he neither feared nor hated any one of them.
Yeah, objection.
You think that there were instances here?
Well, we know that he slayed the Praetorian guards who put the sword at Nerva's throat, but anyway, besides those...
I think that's why Dio says he honoured all good men.
Yes.
So that we can see the get-out clause.
Okay, all right. So besides those group of people and the Dacians and anyone else who came about us,
they don't matter.
What has Trajan done for us?
Well, this actually is something that is important in a leader and perhaps harks back to Julius Caesar. To slanders, he paid very little heed and he was no slave of anger. Again, it contrasts with the bad emperors who won't hear a word against them, which is a marker of tyranny and I think probably is still something that we would say. If you can't take a joke, then you shouldn't be in charge. You shouldn't be up there in public. He refrained equally from the money of others and from unjust murders. The second part of that sentence seems slightly more important to me and perhaps is a repetition of what we've already had, although the word unjust suggests we might have just murders. He expended vast sums on wars and vast sums on works of peace. Can you see the balance that we're getting here, even in that sentence? Both of these are good things, according to Dio, but also that he balances that out by paying for civic works. He cares about what you need in peace as well. While making very many urgently needed repairs to roads and harbours and public buildings, he drained no one's blood for any of these undertakings.
See, I thought he got a lot of his money from the war on Dacia.
Exactly.
We kind of covered that.
That's one of the reasons to pursue that war.
Yeah.
And that's one of the good outcomes from it, as far as Dacia is concerned. He was so high-minded and generous that after enlarging and embellishing the circus, the racetrack, which is a good thing to do for the entertainment of the people, the circus which had crumbled away in places, he merely inscribed on it a statement that he had made it adequate for the Roman people. I know what quote you're thinking of here, by the way.
Yeah.
Are you thinking of Nero saying something similar when he goes into his golden house?
No, actually, I wasn't. I actually wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking of an Augustus quote about leaving it clothed in marble. But
Well, I mean, Augustus is often praised for, in terms of his building works, he's doing it for the people, for public consumption, not for private use.
Mm.
And that's what's going on here as well. So again, the parallel with Augustus is a good one. For these deeds now, he took more pleasure in being loved than being honoured. His association with the people was marked by affability and his intercourse with the Senate by dignity. Very important to senators. And remember, Dio is a senator.
Mm.
And so that he was loved by all and dreaded by none, save the enemy. They're the people you want to dread you. He joined others in the chase, that means hunting, and in banquets, as well as in their labours and plans and jests. So he's sort of one of the ordinary guys, or he can be, when he steps down from being emperor. He's all things to all people. Often he would take three others into his carriage and he would enter the houses of citizens, sometimes even without a guard. And he would enjoy himself there. That's another marker of stepping down to their level. Education in the strict sense he lacked when it came to speaking. This is quite rare and perhaps marks a beginning, a change in the kind of person we get as emperor.
So he's not a natural orator.
No. Well, and even the word natural is interesting there because part of traditional Roman education is you get trained in that, the art of rhetoric and how to speak. Of course, that had been particularly important during the Republic because one of the ways you got ahead in politics is becoming less and less important. He's a doer, not a talker.
Yeah.
But Dio goes on. But its substance he both knew and applied, so he could get by. It's an interesting parallel to me with what happens on Trajan's Column, what's depicted there, as we've discussed in the When in Rome podcast, because Trajan is often seen speaking to the troops there.
Mm.
So he's being depicted in this very important leadership role, doing, I mean, you can't tell from basically a still how good the speech was, but the troops look entranced. And that is meant to be one of his roles, to inspire the troops. According to Dio, it wasn't his forte. It's not his greatest strength, but he was good enough.
But two very different audiences, rallying the troops and speaking to the Senate.
I guess so, yes. Yeah. Different things are required. But of course, there's a skill in talking to people that you're soon going to ask to go out and die for you. Dio finishes up this particular sentence by saying there was no quality which he did not possess in a high degree. So he had everything.
Yep. Let's delve into some of Trajan's good qualities then, as Dio just waxed lyrically about. And we've seen a lot of examples of this before. So we've talked about him entertaining the masses. So just take us through that briefly in this kind of context. How did he show the people that he appreciated them or that they should appreciate him?
It is a two-way process.
Yeah.
Well, the circus that is mentioned there is very important because it's the most popular Roman entertainment. But we do know that he also put on gladiatorial games to celebrate his victory in Dacia.
So two distinct kind of arenas there. Well, literally arenas.
Yep.
One's the Ben-Hur kind of horse racing one, isn't it? And the other is gladiators go in, animals go in, one shall leave kind of scenario. Sorry, that's very dramatic.
Well, the animals probably didn't leave. We've said before that he put on 123 days of these spectacles in the arena to celebrate the Dacian victory. This is a huge boon for the masses. Lots of free entertainment and brought in, you know, very exotic beasts. Of course, he had lots of money after Dacia. But you're quite right. It's a two-way process because all of this honors Trajan. So it's 123 days of thinking Trajan's great.
Yeah. We never got these sort of games under Domitian, did we?
No, and Nerva was a bit boring.
Yeah. So as well as entertaining the masses, he's improving Rome. He's improving the Roman Empire.
Well, a lot of what Trajan does is very nuts and bolts, practical. which sort of fits, I suppose, with the stereotype of the military general. So he's building new roads, particularly throughout Italy. He's involved in a project to drain the marshes called the Pontine Marshes, just south of Rome, which were perennially a problem. They'd flood, and he dredges them and builds a new road through it so that people can, you know, they can engage in trade and get through that area. And that's seen as a big plus. And he builds a new harbour at Ostia, which is the port of Rome. He also builds a new bath building, which is still, if you can believe it, the tail end of building over Nero's golden house. Mm. So Nero's still an easy target, it seems to me, in terms of I'm a better emperor than him. So he's giving lots of these useful and leisure activities to the Romans. Also, of course, we've got, as a direct result of the Dacian victory, a sparkling new forum, an imperial forum that he builds, and behind it, a new marketplace, which is a building that's still very prominent in Rome that you can see just behind Trajan's forum. So again, that's a very practical structure. Within the forum, he's got two libraries, public libraries. So this is part of what the masses want or need, giving them things. He also reissues the money, so he gets rid of a whole lot of coinage that's badly damaged and he reissues it, which hasn't been done in a while. There's a big marker of this, actually, not in Rome itself, but in southern Italy, southern central Italy, at a place called Benevento, Beneventum for the Romans, which is a triumphal arch. It's a triple arch, so much bigger than the Arch of Titus, but it's not an arch that's about a triumph over a people. The Arch at Beneventum has lots of those civic, practical scenes represented on it. So the emperor giving benefactions to the people, giving them corn dole, or, you know, giving them civic structures that they need. And it's built over a road that he built. So it's sort of about his victory over want, if you like, victory over things that the Italian peoples need, as opposed to over a foreign enemy.
I guess you could look at it then maybe as by plonking it not in Rome, but in the middle of the country, in the middle of the boot, you're declaring victory over the country itself, maybe, not just the capital. I don't know, reading too much into it.
No, there's a very good reason why it's not in Rome, why it's in provincial Italy.
Yeah.
For one thing, it shows Trajan's interested in that area. But at the same time, you know, a triumphal arch is a big statement. Of course, he's not saying I've triumphed over the Italian people. They've been incorporated for far too long. But it is a reminder of what the emperor has done for you.
Mm. All right. So Trajan seems to be doing everything right. So were there any threats to his power? And how can anyone justify trying to bump Trajan off?
Well, of course, there's always talk about threats. And the main talk around Trajan's reign seems to really zone in on a character called Licinius Sura, who's a fellow Spaniard, Roman citizen, who Dio seems to think, at least people thought, was a potential rival or a danger in some way because he had a lot of influence. He was very powerful. He had already been consul once when Trajan came to power. But as Dio tells us, Trajan actually, if he did feel any threat from Sura, then he used that tactic of keep your enemies close because he made him consul a further two times. And he used to visit him in his house. Apparently on one occasion, he allowed himself to be shaved and fed there, which is, you know, an easy opportunity to kill the emperor. So he sort of shows supreme self-confidence. He shows that he doesn't perceive any threat from Sura. This is another thing that is used to speak well of Trajan, that he's not paranoid like Domitian. He doesn't see a rival around every corner.
It had to be confidence. It couldn't be ignorance, could it? People must be telling him, you know, Sura, you know, watch out for that guy.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, who knows what the relationship between the two was? Maybe it just was a very comfortable relationship and other people were jealous. But it may well be that if you read Dio, what he's implying is that Trajan neutralized the threat by keeping him happy with high prestige, but not allowing him any higher than that.
So do you think that Trajan was being a bit overconfident then?
Well, if he was, it's something that is repeated throughout his reign. Another quote that we have from Dio is that he tells the Praetorian prefect, basically tells him, I trust you absolutely. you probably shouldn't, given the history of what had happened to emperors with praetorian prefects. He's supposed to have said to his praetorian prefect, take this sword in order that if I rule well, you may use it for me, but if ill, against me. Trajan was aware that he was a good emperor.
Mm.
That's what it implies. Or maybe you could read it differently. He was aware that others had been corrupted by power, and he was trying to ensure that didn't happen to him.
All right, so Devil's Advocate says that this is a flaw. He is overconfident that at some point that could go against him. Were there any other flaws that we know of? What does Dio tell us? Is Dio critical at all?
Maybe he realizes that no one can be this perfect, because the quote that I gave before from book 68, chapter 6, continues. We're actually in chapter 7 by this point. It continues, I know, of course, that he was devoted to boys and to wine. But if he had ever committed or endured any base or wicked deed as a result of this, he would have incurred censure.
Okay, wait. So is that a bad thing? Well, being devoted to boys and wine, is that in that instance being saying that he's excessive?
Well, I mean, certainly pederasty isn't looked at in the same way as we would look at it. The word devoted implies he liked wine a bit too much. All right, but what Dio immediately comes in with the counter to that, saying nothing bad ever came of it. The problem with being devoted to anything for the Romans was that it might mean that you were unable to be a good leader. You weren't moderate. You couldn't kind of contain your own desires. Therefore, you can't rule well. It's exactly what Nero was accused of.
Yeah.
What Dio says is these are potential flaws for a leader, but it didn't affect his leadership. As it was, however, he drank all the wine he wanted, yet remained sober. And in his relation with boys, he harmed no one. So that's what could potentially go wrong. You could get drunk and make a fool of yourself. We're all familiar with that. It didn't happen with Trajan. He drank lots of wine, but he was fine. He goes on, and I think this is an interesting statement. Even if he did delight in war, nevertheless, he was satisfied when success had been achieved, a most bitter foe overthrown, and his countrymen exalted. So it's an interesting phrase, I think. Even if he did delight in war, and the implication there is some people are just warmongers. They want to go to war for the sake of it. They want their own personal glory. Trajan went to war, conquered the enemy, stopped.
Okay.
It's all about he knew when to stop. He had moderation. And just to finish up, nor did the result which usually occurs in such circumstances, conceit and arrogance on the part of the soldiers, ever manifest itself during his reign. With such a firm hand did he rule them.
So he never lost control of the military.
Exactly. That's exactly what someone like Suetonius accuses emperors like Caligula and Nero of doing, of not having a firm hand on the military. And that's why everything goes to pot. You know, everything falls apart for Roman society when the emperor isn't in control of all aspects of Roman society, not just the army.
We know that the people were happy with Trajan. We know that the military is happy with Trajan. Were the Senate happy? How did they express their gratitude that Trajan is being such a good emperor?
Well, they were happy, and we know that because Dio is a senator, and he reports that he honoured the Senate. So really, I think if Dio had any evidence to the opposite, then he would have mentioned it. And we also know that the Senate gave Trajan an honorific name, and that was Optimus Princeps, which means the best emperor, which is the best name to have, really.
We've had Dacia, but we've got one more instance where he gathers up the troops, perhaps gets a bit bored with life in Rome and life in the Senate and opening a new bathhouse, and goes and has a campaign against Parthia. What year is this to start with?
This is 113 CE. And Trajan goes out apparently to fix a situation that's gone wrong in the neighbouring state of Armenia. Armenia has a client king, a king who is a client to Rome. So in other words, he gets to rule, but Rome is technically in charge and certainly has a lot of authority. And an Armenian called Osroes decides that he's not happy with the client king, so he replaces him with his own nephew. So really, Trajan goes over to Armenia in order to reestablish Roman authority there.
Right. So Rome wasn't happy with the client king that they put in place. But yeah, they did it anyway just to see how far they could push things.
The Armenians did it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, presumably because they felt put out by, you know, there are always power struggles, especially if someone is seen as, sometimes people use this terminology of client kings, that they're sort of puppets to Rome. And if they want more autonomy, more local autonomy, they might try and get rid of the client king. Trajan responds in a very deliberate manner by conquering Armenia. So he says, okay, if you're not going to be happy with the client king that we've put in place, we'll make you a province.
Yeah.
And that's what he does. He marches in with his army and conquers it.
Right. So no client king anymore. That is now Roman territory.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he's expanding the Roman Empire. He's already done it in Dacia, going over the Danube, and now he's going to the east. Now he's very close to Parthia. And, of course, this was probably the intention all along, because Parthia is the long-standing enemy of Rome. And it's been rankling for a long time, this idea that Parthia out in the east is potentially a rival to Rome. And it kind of isn't anymore. But there is a history which we can trace all the way back to the first century BCE, when, if anyone listened way back when we talked about Julius Caesar, in 53 BCE, one of Julius Caesar's colleagues, Crassus, went out to Parthia to conquer and lost three legions, lost the standards, which weren't recovered until several decades later.
Augustus got those back, didn't he?
He did, in 20 BCE.
Sent Tiberius to do it. It's on a statue.
Well remembered.
Wow, there we go.
Remember the name of the statue?
Augustus the Great.
Augustus the Prima Porta. It's on his breastplate.
Close enough.
Yeah. So Parthia is still a problem. They got those standards back, but that was a negotiation. There's no conquest involved. So you could say Roman honours at stake here, and this is a good way for Trajan to continue his reputation as a warrior emperor.
You could say that Roman honours at stake, but you can also say that Trajan's just opportunistic. He's got all his men there, and he's just looking across the border and going, yeah, I can take them. Why not? Let's go, guys. That's how good he was at speeches, I hear.
It's opportunistic in as much as it might have done Trajan's reputation good.
Mm.
But as we will see, all of Trajan's activity on this campaign sort of has to be backtracked later.
Yeah.
This might be Trajan taking the Roman Empire too big, stretching it further than it can cope with. And that's the general consensus on what happens in this campaign.
With this ambition in mind to take on Parthia, how did he start that kind of campaign?
Well, he starts by conquering cities in Parthia. And by 115, he's wintering in Antioch, which is in Syria, so just outside that zone. But the whole project is somewhat beset with difficulty when there's a big earthquake there, which kills people, including the consul who's traveling with him, who's called Pedo. Trajan, apparently man of action, escaped by climbing through a window, according to Dio, who also says that Trajan supposedly saw some kind of supernatural, superhuman being leading him from the window. Which actually may be a story that Trajan reported and could even be true, because apparently such things are often reported when people are trapped in buildings, that they see some kind of image of a god figure or an angel leading them to the light.
He can also use that as justification that he's probably doing the right thing in Parthia.
I guess so. You're very suspicious of him in Parthia, I can tell.
I'm sorry.
You weren't like this over Dacia.
They had it coming.
Okay, so there are some stumbling blocks there, but he continues, which I guess if you're going to be on the Roman side in terms of empire and conquest, shows certainly determination on Trajan's part. And he proceeds to the area we would know perhaps as Mesopotamia, to Babylon. And he apparently has a plan to join together the two major rivers of that region, the Euphrates and the Tigris, by building a canal, which sort of reminds me of some of the rather daft plots that people like Caligula had, where he wanted to build canals through bits of Campania around Naples just to make his life easier and build bridges over unfeasibly big distances. But Trajan is told by his engineers, no, it's too far, you can't do it.
Yeah.
And backs off from it.
So is he coming up against a lot of resistance here? It's sounding a bit blasé. And
well, Dio doesn't really tell us about the nitty-gritty of the battles.
Yeah.
So, and this is often something that military historians are quite annoyed by, that we don't get that kind of detail. And eventually he takes Ctesiphon, which is the capital of Parthia. And that just happens, apparently. This is seen as a victory by his troops, though, because they salute him at that point with the name Imperator, which you might think emperors always have, but technically it's a term given by the soldiers to their leader when they feel like they've carried out a great victory. So that's still happening, even though he's always Imperator, really, and that's our word for emperor. The Senate, then, this is my favourite bit of what the Senate does for Trajan. They give him the right to celebrate as many triumphs as he wants. He can just pick them out. It's not just a Parthian triumph. He could have them over individual cities and presumably over Armenia and just carry on having triumphs. Maybe they're thinking of those 123 days of arena games and they want more of that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And they give him an extra name as well, don't they?
They give him the name Parthicus.
So he goes, great, got to reorder the business cards again.
Well, that would appear on coinage, of
yeah.
course.
Well,
so
yeah.
In a way, there is a reissue going on. I mean, when you conquer a region, that's not unusual. Lots of people were given the name Germanicus. Domitian had been. Trajan had Dacicus from Dacia. But I think Parthicus is sort of a big deal because of that historical enmity between Rome and Parthia.
Did he like it?
He preferred Optimus.
Oh, why wouldn't you?
That kind of covers everything. Well, Dio says it's because it's about his character,
yes.
not about his military victories alone. If you read Dio, you really get the impression this is somebody who's interested in their own PR. He really wants to leave a good reputation of what he was like as a character.
So by all intents and purposes, Parthia is a great and fairly easy victory for Trajan. I mean, I'm probably blaseing a lot of Roman soldiers dying there. But he's happy with his success, isn't he?
Yes, he is. But it starts to fall apart fairly quickly. There are revolts going on behind him.
So this gets back to being stretched a bit too thin.
They're
conquering so much territory that they're not cleaning up properly behind them.
Yeah, in fact, it gets so dangerous that Trajan decides to instate a client king in Parthia. So it won't actually be a province. But the Parthians don't want the person that he gives to them. And the eastern conquests overall begin to unravel somewhat. He has to travel to Arabia to put down another revolt. And at that point, he becomes ill. So part of the unraveling is Trajan's own health. He won't complete this conquest because of that.
Mm.
There is also an idea that Trajan wanted to go as far as India. Of course, like many generals modelling himself on Alexander the Great, he travels to the Persian Gulf so that he can actually look in that direction and see what the ancients called ocean, which is the Arabian Sea, that bit of the Indian Ocean, I suppose. And he says, I should certainly have crossed over to India too if I were still young. So Trajan himself is starting to feel old at this point. And when he falls ill, of course, everything is pretty much put on hold. This is in 117. Dio says at this point he suffers a stroke, but Trajan, uncharacteristically given what we've said, apparently suspected poison. So perhaps he did become somewhat paranoid towards the end. He doesn't know who the poisoner is, though, if that is a firm suspicion. Towards the end, in the room that he dies in, indeed, he sacrifices to Alexander, still got him in mind, and he dies on the 8th of August, 117 CE.
He did finish the Parthia campaign more or less. He incorporates part of Parthia into Rome. And is the rest left as a client king at all? Or
No, the Parthian conquest never really gets resolved.
Okay.
As we'll see when we look at Hadrian. Hadrian, who's the next emperor, very quickly lets most of this conquest go.
Yeah.
He just sees it as too difficult.
But the way that Trajan leaves things in 117, this is the biggest that the Roman Empire has been or ever will be.
It is indeed. And that's the map that's often shown of the Roman Empire at its greatest extent.
In 117, yeah.
I show it to my students all the time, and yet it is indeed in 117 CE. Because straight after that, it's going to get smaller. We have some campaigns up in Germania, up in Northern Europe after that. And it's going to be a few centuries before things really start to shrink.
So he's succeeded by his adopted son, Hadrian, who is also his nephew. And we'll talk about that succession kind of interesting dance there in the Hadrian podcast. So where is he buried?
His remains are in the base of the column that he had built in his own forum, the column that celebrates his victories over Dacia. which is the first time that human remains have been allowed to remain within the city. Mm. Normally, tombs are outside the city. So this is very unusual, and his wife's remains will be put in here too after her death. I think this might be the final proof that the Senate's really quite happy with Trajan, that they allowed that because it's exceptional.
Yeah. He's generally left Rome and the rest of history with a really great impression of the kind of emperor that he was, wasn't he? I mean, I know that we've included him in the so-called, quotation fingers, five good emperors, but I kind of think that he was the best. It's pretty high up between him and Augustus.
Optimus Princeps.
Yes, Optimus Princeps, victory lap for Trajan. But that's generally the kind of impression that we have of him, isn't it?
Well, we don't get any negative evidence. And who knows what some people thought, but it's very hard to argue that Trajan put a foot wrong. And I don't want to say he was a great guy. He's wonderful. It's more that he seems to have played the part of being an emperor really well. I would say that he's probably learned from the mistakes of others. I mean, presumably some of this is natural, but he's decided to be this kind of character, to act in this way towards the Senate, to do a certain amount of conquest, but not spend all his time away from Rome. And he's trod that path really well because he's emperor for 19 years, longer than some people have been. And it's seen as a remarkably successful reign from the point of view of the Romans. And in many ways, he's linked with Augustus, who, as we've seen all the way along, emperors get compared to Augustus. They're not as good as Augustus in whatever fashion. But Trajan is linked to Augustus in all kinds of ways, and no more so than by the phrase which the Romans seem to have had as a motto, which, according to a 4th-century source, was said to every new emperor after Trajan, which is "Sis felicior Augusto, melior Traiano," which means "be more fortunate than Augustus and better than Trajan."
So that's the benchmark that they were setting then.
Yeah, if you can be that good, it's almost like saying, well, no one's really going to be that good. But if you can be that good, then you will be a brilliant emperor.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Please leave a review there. Reviews are appreciated and always read. And tell your friends about it. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we take the time to look at some sources and examine the life of the writer Suetonius. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.